Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name is Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Richard Cabot. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stuart. I'm really looking forward to the whole experience.
I'm sure you are. For the listener who can't see, I'm looking at a very sincere face right now. and also, there's that moment of like, we've just spent about half an hour preambling, and now I'm having to say hello and welcome and introduce myself again, which is always a bit weird, even for me, trust me.
I wasn't being ironic.
We're going to do 5 great punk films with you, and they're a great list, and we'll get onto them very soon. But okay. I mean, I came to you because I saw write ups about Looking for a Kiss, and then I found a book you'd written, co-edited and authored, an anthology, Punk is Dead, Underneath He Killed Every Night, and then there's the 2019 book Dark Entries, and I think our mutual friend was Kathy Unsworth, wasn't it? I think that's a connection between the two of us that helped me introduce myself to say, come on the podcast.
Yeah. I know Kathy. Kathy's lovely, and she's a cool writer as well. And I heard the show that you did, and it was wonderful. And that's one of the things that is making me look forward to this. Total film experience.
So do you want, I mean, as a kind of qualifier then, thinking of those books and your own sort of experience as a writer in the newspapers and magazines and stuff, you know, just give people paint a picture of people as to your own experience of punk full stop, I suppose.
I suppose my experience of punk is fairly typical. I come from a small suburban town called Dunstall, about 30 miles up to the M1. Mm-hmm. And I grew up, I was born in 1960, and I grew up in the kind of 70s, did most of my growing up in the 70s.
Yeah.
And at that time in suburbia, the experience of youth, including myself, it was all about conformity. Things, you know, concepts like irony, that they didn't exist. You had to conform. You conformed to survive, basically, because if you thought outside of certain parameters, then you'd perhaps be up for a good kicking, really. And it was a very violent era, and those parameters that I talked about, I suppose, were prescribed by, for instance, I went to a grammar school, which turned into a comp, and the whole issue the whole purpose of that school really was to provide either people to go on the production line, or if you were of the grammar school standard, then you would work for the civil service. And I didn't really know what I wanted, but I didn't want any of that stuff. And there were people who had perhaps been going out with each other, couples. They'd been going out with each other maybe for years at school, while they were at school. And I'd kind of look at them and they, you know, what are you doing tonight? And they were, you know, going around Trevor's house, and they'd go around each other's houses, and they'd sit in front of the TV together, and they wouldn't say anything to each other. And it was kind of like this preparation for being married. And I knew that I certainly didn't want that, but I didn't know what I wanted. And I didn't know really what I wanted until punk came along. And what punk did, overnight, All the former youth kingpins that had ruled the roost in terms of those kind of parameters I talked about, you know, where you'd go to the pub, you'd go to football, you'd have a fight, you'd go out with Nancy and you'd go around her house and not say anything. All those people, the boot boys, and then, you know, the slightly more the grammar schooly people who had the prog rock rubbish. You know, all of those former youth kingpins suddenly meant nothing. And not only did they mean nothing, they were laughable. And not only that, but they knew it somehow. They suddenly realised that they didn't matter. They didn't matter anymore. And what punk did was they helped to formulate certain things in your mind. As culture does, I think, you know, film and music and books, etc. And so what pop punk did is it inspired you to kind of, no, of course nobody, we didn't know the people who had gone to punk what we wanted. But it was a question of ripping up what had formerly been the rule book, throwing it up in the air, see where the pieces land. And punk was, it was inspirational for one reason, really, and it was a roadmap to a future, and it did that by connecting a lot of wonderful things, such as, you know, clothes and sex and, you know, ideas and politics and art. And music, of course, because it had to be fun. So it was good to have things to jump up and down to. So that was my...
Out of interest, then, what was the kind of first touchstone for you then in that kind of, in that awakening, as it were, from...
In terms of punk rock?
Yeah. What did you first come across, as it were, that sort of went, hold on a minute, this isn't normal?
Right, well, I guess the first exposure I would have had to punk rock in its pure sense would have been there was a little piece and a picture of Sex Pistols at the Nashville in April 1976, and described a fight that the Sex Pistols had. With members of their own audience. And I kind of looked at this, and you couldn't see Johnny Rotten's eyes. He was kind of looking away or down. But in my mind now, I have him and the look in his eyes, and the spark in his eyes, that kind of spark spoke of violence, but it wasn't the kind of violence that I was used to, which is the violence that I mentioned, which was the football violence and perhaps kind of fighting at school, you know, the bullying even, and it wasn't that at all. You could see in his eyes, which I didn't see, but which I saw.
I got you.
And it was a different sort of violence, and it was a creative violence, and it spoke of destruction. And I think as Malcolm said, you've got to destroy to create. And that was my first exposure to punk in its pure sense. But before then, I mean, you know, I'd seen that year I had seen Dr. Feelgood play. So I knew that something was going on. Because they were, you know, they weren't your kind of everyday band, shall we say, that kind of plodded about the kind of circuit. They had a real electricity to them. So in terms of music, you know, there had been that, for instance, the Feel Good thing, and then the Pistols thing came along. And then I think in August of that year, the Hot Rods released a single, it was EP, Live at the Marquee, which was kind of a real intro for people, I think, to punk. I mean, you know, nobody likes eating the Hot Rods these days, and they're considered as rubbish. And I think that if you spoke to, and I have spoken to people who were kind of in that, shall we say, the cognoscenti at that time, nobody liked the Hot Rods, you know, people like the 101ers. But for me, you know, suburban kid, everyday suburban kid, it was the kind of Hot Rods. And oh, wow, you know. And then Anarchy came out, and I bought that the first week it was out, I think.
I think it's really interesting how significant something like hearing music that doesn't sound like it's from anywhere else you've heard before, from your kind of suburban enclave. I mean, I'm sort of, my experience was sort of 10 years after yours in a sense, where I'm in a post-industrial town 10 miles outside of Manchester, wondering, is this it? And then you hear noises from outside of your comfort zone, because obviously there was no internet then. And you begin to open your mind up to possibilities as to where culture might go beyond the stuff that you're given.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's a typical, well, archetypal experience. As I think I said, I mean, you know, we all went through that that kind of birth. And I mean, you know, what punk did is it's for all of a sudden, all the people who had felt as I did pre-punk as outsiders, and who were perhaps bullied, and who felt different and who just couldn't fit in, you know, but didn't kind of want to express their boredom through typical means like drinking, you know, down the pub every night and holding Nancy's hand. You know, we found each other. It was a place. It was a location to find other people who were like you, you know. And that was kind of important. Community is important. And I mean you know, if people kind of say, you know, is punk dead? Well, no, it's not dead, because punk it was never a simple youth cult. It wasn't, you know, mods or teddy boys where you kind of, you know, wore a pair of brothel creepers and then you settled down and got married and, you know, forgot all about that rubbish and perhaps played a rock and roll record every year to remind you of your youth. It wasn't that. It was punk was something different. And it was different because it included a lot of things. It included art, ideas, you know, music, sex, bondage trousers, tower blocks, you know, the whole lot. It just doesn't, that, you know, we're still trying to work it out now.
I was just thinking that, I mean, this is a bit fanciful, so by all means swerve it. Could you imagine trying to explain to your 15, 16-year-old self you'd still be talking about it 45 years later?
Well, I knew that I'd still be talking about the kind of things that I was interested in. So yeah, I'm not gonna kind of like stop talking about art or ideas or creativity and.
But also you were to be at the start of something that has been so influential. I mean, it's a reminder as well as to how young youth culture was, 1977. Tony Wilson used to always, he had his fanciful idea that you had 55, 66, 77, 88, we were kind of almost like the big moments in sort of, certainly music culture.
Well, that was actually Caroline Coon, because she, quite early on, she brought out the book called 1988.
Okay.
Yeah, and she brought it out in 1977, and people kind of asked her, why is it called 1988? Because she said, that's when the next big youth cult is going to be because of the process you've just described.
Wow, I didn't know.
It was kind of acid house, wasn't it?
That was
kind of like the one, really, if you kind of discount the sort of nostalgia stuff like Mod, etc., the next kind of real big, fresh sort of thing happening, So it was kind of like, wow, okay.
Well, it certainly was the last new thing, as you could call, honestly call new.
Yeah. No, so yes. Yeah, so if Tony Wilson repeated that, then they're both right, Tony and Caroline.
Nice to learn that. Now, what's interesting, and you said it quite a bit in what you were saying, is that punk wasn't just about, music. It was more than that, wasn't it? And I think the five films that you've selected will enable you to sort of convey a lot more about what punk is, and not necessarily to say what punk isn't, but I suppose they aren't obvious in choices. I mean, one or two are, but certainly they're not all. And that's kind of what's going to be interesting about this discussion in the choices.
Well, it describes the five films. They describe an arc that we'll kind of go into, I was going to talk about creativity, the creative aspect of the punk experience, really. So you have character arcs in films, and you have creative arcs, and I mean, certainly we'll be able to see that in these five films. But the arc, as far as my writing and creativity is concerned, that started definitely kind of with punk. Really, I started writing my own fanzine because it was a way of escape. Music or creativity has always been a way of escaping your surroundings in whatever way, and especially if you don't do things for kind of lust of result, as it were. If you do things for we were talking before for the love of them, and if you do that often, I find that magically, even though you haven't really thought about, I'm going to do this fanzine because I know that it's going to get me a top job in media. Mm. Even you don't think that, but magically, and I think it is magic, and it often happens, it works for you if things start to happen. So in any case, I started this fanzine in Dunstable in Bedfordshire, and I started writing about punk, and then it kind of you start to meet people, you encounter other ideas, you start talking to people, and you want to kind of move, and that's the process that writing that fanzine got me into, and it got me into certain creative punk circles rather than other punk circles, which perhaps we'll go on to describe or talk about later in relation to one of the films, Jubilee. But So yeah, no.
I like that notion of sort of the creative spark of it all, because I think a lot of youth movements, if they get other people to go, well, what can I do? Like, if I can't do that, what can I do? Then it's kind of working, don't you? Because people are wondering how they can contribute as opposed to just consume.
Well, it used to be like the thing, you know, in the ghetto, the only way out was through boxing or music. Mm. Well, in punk, you know, the way that, you know, it would get suburban kids out of the suburbs was either through music or through writing fanzines. They were the two kind of things. So I couldn't play guitar at the time, and I'm better now, actually. I'm all right now, to tell you the truth. But in any case, writing was the thing, so I started that. And then what happened was, it got to a certain point, and you know, you want to kind of move on, really. And I started writing for the NME.
Okay.
In 1982, I started writing for the NME, and I simply did it. I just simply sent a live review off to the NME, because they weren't covering the bands that I was going to see, and they were bands, kind of new, fresh, young bands. Some of them were kind of from that sort of crass stable. I think the first band that I sent stuff in on, or that was published with, maybe the Flux of Pink Indians. Do you remember them?
It was 1982.
But then I started writing about a whole bunch of new sort of punk bands, which I then wrote a front cover piece on called Positive Punk, which was about the kind of colourful flash bands. But I think we'll talk about that again in relation to one of the films that we're going to talk about, and that is for Rocky Horror Show, I think. Rocky Horror Picture Show. But it was that it was exciting at the time in 1982, punk, you know. I mean, punk went through its own kind of arc, and you know, it was great in 1977 and 78. It was like this, you know, it was kind of like the first sort of down a Monday in January. It was kind of, it's horrible, lots of casualties happening.
Really?
Yeah, 78, 79. But then by the end of the decade, it was a resurgence. There were lots of kids, you know. And it was, you know, some would say that punk was better then, you know. Because before, I mean, you know, punk was largely kind of isolated for most people. Not when I say isolated, I mean people would be listening to the records and talking about them, going to gigs and all that kind of stuff. But by the end of the 70s, 80s, it did become more of a community through punk squatting, actually. Mm. You know, so mass punk squatting, I mean, there were kind of hundreds, thousands maybe of punk squatters in London. There was lots of housing stock, and people had the will and the energy to do that, and to kind of you had two ends of it. You had the kind of real sort of scuzzy punks who'd squat and maybe just take a lot of tunal and sniff a load of glue and be out of it all the time. But then on the other hand, there was a real creative thrust to
this parallels, swing. Isn't there, between London and New York in that sense, isn't there? And in that sort of time period when there was either affordable and or unused buildings.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's absolutely the case. I think New York definitely around or just after you had the kind of no wave scene, which was kind of inhabited by a lot of those people who lived dirt cheap and who kind of lived their art and crashing through that barrier between life and art. Yeah,
Well, shall we get into the films then, and start to break up that narrative arc then, as you see it. Before we do, I will give the listener who's not heard this font before a quick rundown of what's going to happen. I've got five films listed. I will announce them each time we get to them. And when the dog barks at 5 minutes, we'll draw that one to a close and we'll move on to the next one in the list. The only reason being is I'm too polite to tell you to stop talking. So the dog barking is my passive aggressive reminder for the guest. And it also means that we spend equal amount of time sort of picking up the main points about each of the films you've selected, because they are a great selection and they straddle two decades. So that speaks to its own ideas of what you say is a narrative, is an arc, as it were, that punk went on. So every 5 minutes, the dog will bark, and I will start you off. The first one will go 1966, Chelsea Girls by Andy Warhol.
First off, I haven't rewatched this film, and I haven't rewatched any of the films. And we were talking a little bit before, weren't we, about the actual kind of the way of thinking about films that you've seen, especially meaningful films that you've seen. And I kind of think that the films and the sort of meaningful films, again, they what they do is you don't just simply remember them. They kind of inhabit you. Mm. They become part of you, and you know, in a way, you're kind of, well, not living them. You're not going to be Andy Warhol or anything like that. But they are part of your makeup, and
they implant a memory, as I like to think it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what it is, I think, with not kind of rewatching films, it is like exactly like memory, because what you do is you recontextualize it in the same way that you recontextualize memories. So what you have is that not perhaps this notion of that of reality of what really happened. But you have kind of like the true, I think, the truth. Is it actually what happened? Well, probably not. Is it the truth? Yes, it is, because it's made up of everything that happened afterwards, including everything that happened in your imagination.
So what does Chelsea Girls for you, what does that spark for you first off then? Where does that start in punk, as a punk selection?
Yeah, okay. Well, Chelsea Girls was shot at the Chelsea Hotel largely. I think that he did it in a kind of other apartments as well, but mostly it's Chelsea Girls, the Chelsea Hotel. And yeah, it was made in 66, and then I think it came out in 1967. Of course, it was by Warhol and a guy called Paul Morrissey, who some people like in context of Warhol, and some people don't like. And I mean, the thing about Chelsea Girls, I mean, in terms of its style, is it lasted 3.5 hours, but it features a non-narrative structure in which the characters that kind of extensively verbally, physically assault one another, you know, say horrible things, and then just kind of really do nothing. It's an experimental thing. So what? And because they wanted to kind of make it a little bit more commercial, which is a laughable idea if you've ever seen Chelsea Girls, they actually
just a little bit laughable, yes.
And what they did is that they put it into a split screen format, which means that there are two films happening at the same time.
So it's a good 7-hour film in real.
Real times, it is. It's an absolutely fantastic. It's a fantastic idea, and
Do you think, in a way, it's an idea of its time? Because, you know, we were in a I guess you would call it like a media, like certainly visual media poor era. So the idea of making a 3.5-hour film of anything wouldn't be seen as indulgent as it would be to this day, even though it would be indulgent back then.
Yeah, I think he did it purely out of off the top of his head. I think he made it up as he went along. And I think that Paul Morrissey thought, well, we can't have a seven and a half hour film. We're going to make it into 3.5 hours. Basically, because he wants to sell it. Paul Morrissey was the guy who wanted to bring Warhol out into the world, rather than have him kind of in some sort of small place in a dingy club in New York. So what you have is you have these stars amongst them, the Warhol superstars, Gerben Langer, Ingrid Superstar, Mary Voronoff, International Velvet, and of course Nico. Was that 5 minutes?
You were worried that 5 minutes would last forever. That's 5 minutes, Richard.
Wow, that's absolutely unbelievable. I've got a whole book's worth of stuff to say about it. I've got to up my game. I've got to up my speed.
Well, look, that's that. Do you want to finish your thought? Do you want to finish your thoughts on that? Do you want to round your thoughts off?
Yeah, instead of whittering on about the actual kind of format, which is part of it, because we can kind of define, if you want to define punk films, you can define it in a couple of ways, and that's really in terms of punk tone and production values. And Chelsea Girls had all that, as well as the associations with Andy Warhol, who was important to punk rock. And it was his peon, really, to the importance of underground life. And the fabulousness of his own and underground life. So you had an array of these superstars, and it was really a way of demystifying the superstar experience as well. Taking drugs, taking a load of speed, and just being really nasty and being narcissistic and being in love with themselves. And in love with youth, and in love with New York, and in love with a forward, beautiful motion of their own lives, and in love with boredom as well, because the actual format reinforces that notion and tests that notion of boredom. You know, how long can I look at this bit before I flip to the other screen? You know, on the screen. Which is fantastic. And all of those things, including that idea of the inner circle, the cognoscenti, all of it fed into punk rock in 1975 at Malcolm McLaren's shop and in his head. And you can imagine Sid Vicious in this film, Chelsea Girls, which, of course, is kind of ironic because, hey, that's where Sid Vicious ending up and ended up killing Nancy Sponge, and if he did it. And also I went to the Chelsea Hotel as well. I just thought I'd throw that in.
And I'll be honest with you, I lasted an hour with Chelsea Girls. I feel like I watched 2 hours, obviously, because there was two screens going on. But I couldn't afford to give it 3.5 hours of my time. And it's an impossible watch I've got big monitors, I'm not on a laptop, but it's an impossible watch when you're sat at a computer. I can tell you that for nothing.
You see, this is the thing. If you watch it on a computer screen, it's a hard ask.
Well, I think you're just doing it wrong, to be honest with you. I think that's not the way to see it.
Well, no, I think it's kind of, it is a bit, because when you see films on a computer, you've got that kind of freedom to walk away, make a cup of tea, come back, whatever. And we were talking about it's important, the place where you actually see a film. And now I saw that film for the first time in a place in London called the Scala Cinema.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, it was a type of place that was exciting in terms of what was happening in the actual auditorium, as much as as much as what was happening on the screen. Right. It was that kind of locus. It was kind of like the Roxy Club or the Vortex of the cinema.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Scala. It was infamous.
It was a beautiful place. So it was kind of akin to watching it on a computer in that you'd never go to the Scala and watch a film, sit there and watch it kind of all the way through, staring, you know, raptly at the screen. You'd be doing other shit, like, you know, hanging out with people, going off, having sex in the toilets, watching other people have sex, watching people kind of shoot up. Well, you know, there was a cat that kind of wandered around on people's laps, which would be kind of like disturbing enough in itself at certain points, you know, depending on what kind of mood you were in, if you know what I mean. So it was exactly that. Nobody would ever go to see Chelsea Girls, watch it for 3.5 hours solidly. You do other things, and then you come back into it and turn in.
I don't feel so guilty. Right then, your second choice, you're going to jump us 9 years into the future, and we're on the brink of punk rock as you describe your discovery of it, but this is the 1975 film, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Do you want to talk about... Well, let's start with, how did you first see Rocky Horror Show then?
Well, I saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show actually a long time after it had come out.
Okay.
But I had seen the original Rocky Horror Show stage performance down the King's Road in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. It started off, I think, kind of early, 1973 maybe, at the Royal Court Theatre, which is kind of on Sloane Street. But then it moved down a bit later on to the Classic Cinema, which, I mean, it probably doesn't exist anymore. It was the one that you kind of go down towards the World's End.
All right.
And it was on the left. I mean, I haven't been down the King's Road for years, but I mean, I know they used to have gigs there one time. I think Ian Dury, before he even went solo, played there with maybe Kilburn and the Hirons. But in any case, that's where the Rocky Horror Show was in the 70s. So, and it was kind of like going to see the Rocky Horror Show. Was kind of like a precursor, really, to punk for a variety of reasons. And I mean, this is kind of a lot of those reasons are echoed in the film, which is why I kind of thought it was valid to put the film in as well. And I mean, the film came out quite early as well, didn't it? It came out what, 75?
Yeah, 75. Yeah, so it's there on the brink, and I can. It seems like an odd choice in terms of how I think of it, but actually, when you talk about the stage show being something that
I don't know if people have seen it or know about it very much. I mean, I presume that everybody knows about the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but really it's about a couple whose car breaks down and they go to this castle and they encounter this guy, Dr. Frankenfurter, an apparently mad scientist, who's actually an alien transvestite from the planet Transsexual in the galaxy of Transylvania. Oh. Well, I mean, it's fantastic for a number of reasons. And I mean, getting back to the whole punk film, when it was on as a stage play in the 70s, Malcolm and Vivian would have totally gone to see that stage play. They knew most of the people who were involved in that, and most of the people who were involved with that were part of a grouping in London that were kind of pre-punk called Them. Did you ever hear about
no.
a group called Them? It was kind of full of glitzy young movers. So you had people like artists, such as Buggy Fields, and you had your sort of Little Nels, who was actually in the stage play and the film, the Rocky Horror Show. And you had Andrew Logan, whose party the Sex Pistols played at very, very early. And, I mean, you know, you had kind of Malcolm and Vivian knocking at that kind of door and not really being let in. So punk, in a way, I think, was probably a revenge on those people not to kind of, you know, be embraced by them as fully as they perhaps, or recognised by them as fully as they kind of wanted to be, in a way. But in terms of influence, I mean, everybody knows the kind of clothes that for instance that people wore in the film and in the stage play, which is, you know, kind of transvestite gear and ripped fishnet stockings, etc., etc. And it's interesting because I kind of remember.
Go on, finish your thought.
Unbelievable. Patricia Quinn, actress who played Magenta in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, she's adamant that the costume designer, Sue Blaine, who went on to be a real kind of star, actually invented punk.
That's interesting. Because the aesthetic, because you mean the fashion aesthetic idea?
Aesthetically, yeah. Okay. And how Vivian Malcolm really picked up on that. But again, I'm kind of misjudging 5 minutes. I think it's horrible, that timing, Stuart. 5 minutes. I think we need a lot more time. But hey, you know, we can always do a part two. But listen, I mean, for various reasons, I mean, the whole idea of the Rocky Horror Show, which deals with issues such as androgyny, it kind of denaturalizes gender, it kind of talks about and to the suburban experience, which really interacted with glam, which is also part of the situation, which then fed into punk via the Banshees, who had their own kind of dark take on desire, and you had the whole kind of trash and funny aesthetic, because the Rocky Horror Show really was a mishmash of horror and science fiction, but done in a fun way. The same as if you want to take it on that level. I mean, the Banshees took the dark side and ran with it, which is fantastic. Yeah. But you also had bands like the Damn.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
And who took that kind of trashy, fun level. And it was also, you know, it was actually part of a whole kind of cachet of films that came out at that time, which you had films like The Night Porter, and, you know, which had that kind of, you know, chic to it, that kind of Nazi chic, if you like. Mm. And
I was thinking, when you were saying all your description.
The Visconti film was there. It was you had all of that and the Rocky Horror Show all at the same time feeding into it. And perhaps we'll get...
Just think, as you were talking there about, androgyny and the like, you obviously had the New York Dolls were happening, and that was, that was clearly, there's parallels there, isn't there, between what the Rocky Horror Show was doing as a stage production and what the New York Dolls were doing as a band,
Absolutely. And the most important thing about the Rocky Horror Show and the Rocky Horror Picture Show was the line from the film, if there was nothing else, it'd still be important. It was, don't dream it, be it. And that's what punk absolutely essentially was, in terms of sex, in terms of creativity, in terms of whatever you want it to do, don't dream it, be it. And that is something that, when we talked about something inhabiting you, yeah, that lives in you, well, then if there's one thing that lives in you from punk rock, and that's it. Don't dream it, be it.
No, that's absolutely perfect. And it's sort of like, if anyone was ever doubting why you might pick it, then there's the answer.
Exactly, kids. It is. Totally. Don't dream it, be it. Yeah. No. So it was a fabulous and inspirational and fun thing.
Jumping a couple of years on to 1978, we've got Jubilee, Derek Jarman's sort of past, present, and future look at the world through the I don't know, punk rock nihilism. I don't know. I said to you before we started recording, before I start the clock on you, I mean this is a film that really, really stayed with me, and I haven't rewatched it till getting prepared for this podcast. So I was lucky enough to see this on TV in the early 80s when Derek Jarman films were on Channel 4, which, as a young lad of like 12, 13, I had no idea what I was watching. I knew that I was transfixed, and I knew that I wanted to understand it but didn't. But it didn't make me turn it off. It made me go, it obviously stayed with me all this time. And to be honest with you, in a way, I kind of wish I hadn't rewatched it, because the horror of it, as it were, is now lost, because I can see there's an innocence to it now that 40 years later I can see. But then it terrified me that this had been made. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean, as in, it stirred something in me that I hadn't been ready for. And that's kind of exciting with any kind of art. But do you want to tell us, is it too obvious to say, why is this a punk film? Or where does this fit into punk?
Well, it's a punk film for many reasons. Again, the production values, but also the tone and the meaning of it. It's a dystopian vision of a decayed, morally bankrupt Britain seen through the eyes of a time-traveling Queen Elizabeth. And it's all otherworldly, moving out of sync, non-linear, logical. It flows and it weaves and it jars, and it's all skewed vortexes and walls, and it's unsettling heat haze, and it has Blakean insight, and it has a poetry, and it has a dissolution as well. And my book, Looking for a Kiss, which I don't know if we're going to get a chance to talk about books and books that I've written later, but if not, the one book that of mine that I think is worth looking at for people out there is Looking for a Kiss. And one of the characters, a guy called Robert, if I can just refer to this, it kind of explains a few things about it. I'll just read this piece, so it won't take too long. Robert thought of Derek Jarman's film Jubilee, which he had seen several times for the Adam and the Ants footage, for the most truthful depiction of punk of any movie, and never mind Viv Westwood's nonsensical letter to Derek Jarman t-shirt. More recently, he'd realised the film's real significance lay in the John Dee alchemy, aerial time travel scenes and themes. These sparked in him the idea that life was an array of portents and visions for another future life. Obviously, no need for acid, this lad. It was an occult chemistry that inhabited the film's viewer in the same way as the film's first piece of music, Brian Eno's ghostly Slow Water from Music for Films, which rendered the rest of the soundtrack almost inaudible on a certain level. In this respect, it was magic because it made things disappear. Jubilee led Robert to think that even if there is a pattern and substance in this universe, this substance is meant to be hallucinatory and arcane. And if it is meant to be chaotic too, then it also contains a strange acumen which, like the scrying of John Dee and his like, no one ever really fathoms. Jarman has surpassed himself, thought Robert. Plus, he really liked Jordan's twin sets and pearls. That's a bit from my book, Looking for a Kiss, which I think kind of nails all, everything that's brilliant about Jubilee, including really Jordan, who is an actress, and in the way that she possessed punk and that punk possessed her from before punk even existed, makes her the first punk and the queen of punk. And she died very, very recently. You know, I think this film, just even talking about this film is a kind of memorial to her, because she really is the touchstone in the film, the mainspring of the film, and she is the one that projects the attitude that strikes or that struck to British sensibility, and she is the one that in the film really carries forth the meaning of punk, which echoes the Don't Dream It, Be It. And I think that Jarman maybe even kind of uses that line, or that Jordan uses that line. And if not, then it's very close. I forget the actual line itself, but it basically kind of reiterates the punk stance of don't dream it, be it. So all power to Jordan, really.
I mean, the thing watching it with 2022 eyes is actually, as in addition to Jordan, you've got all these other female cast members who are leading the story. There's barely a male character in it who is leading the narrative. It's really progressive in that sense, the film.
Again, it's like the Rocky Horror Show, which really looked and examined in a couple of different ways gender. And again, Jubilee did exactly the same. And perhaps it's no coincidence that Derek Jarman was part of that whole wave and with those sensibilities. So that all the powerful roles, all the main roles were actually women. Mm. You had Jordan, who we've talked about, and again, I just to stress that Jordan was disorderly magic, pointing out beyond the lustreless to a world where it's possible to discover kind of meaning and adventure. And you had the Slits and all those people. But so aside from the women, it was a prophetic film in many ways. Mm. I mean, it kind of it talked about and looked at a corporate future which kind of hadn't been imagined really before at that point. You know, Thatcherism hadn't happened, MTV hadn't happened, apart from in this film. And the other great role is Orlando, who plays Gintz, who, you know, who says they all sign up in the end. And he also says, if you turn up the sound, the volume, then you won't hear the world falling apart.
Yes,
and he's damn well going to sell the sounds on that. He also says, the other great line, the other great inflection that he has, or reflection rather, is saying that people are too busy looking at his crappy movies to notice what else is going on in the world. And it's absolutely prophetic. Which, of course, you have the prophecy of John Dee and you have the prophecy of the film itself. Yeah. And it's a magical film. It works in a whole vortex and a whirl of meanings. And I think you can kind of, again, you can watch it again and again if you like. But that whole idea of being inhabited by a film.
It definitely felt like it was made in the middle of punk happening. You know, its energy is undeniable, I think.
It is, and it's that sometimes it has a really bad energy, and that bad energy, I'm afraid, was part of punk, and it was part of the kind of scene going on at the time that we kind of touched on before, and we won't be able to go into it too much, but there were some bad things happening and some bad squats out there, some real end-of-the-world things going on, believe me. And and Jubilee caught it. It caught that bad vibe mood happening as well. But it also caught the, as I said, the poetry as well. Hats off to Derek and Jordan.
Now, the fourth choice is arguably the sort of a quintessential punk rock film because of who the subject of the film is. And this is 1980s, is The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. So
the reason for The Great Rock and Roll Swindle being a fantastic film, well, I mean, it's Steve Jones plays a detective uncovering the truth about punk, but really it's... what he's trying to do is he's trying to uncover how Malcolm McLaren manipulated the band to the top of the music biz. And really the power and the glory, I think, of The Great Rock and Roll Swindle and its importance lies simply in Malcolm McLaren. I think that if we're going to talk about people, I know that people will disagree and... well, hey, that's the glory of culture. But I mean, but Malcolm McLaren is the kind of outstanding thinker, the outstanding personality, remaining personality in punk rock. Well, when I say remaining, obviously he's not alive, but you know, in culture of punk rock and the reason for this in The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, you can talk about a lot of things, but I guess the main thing we can take from it, it sounds like a lecture really, but it isn't. Really, his idea, and I think it's a great idea, is that music, the ideas themselves are always more important than the music. And I think that one of the lines in it said, you know, if people bought the records for the music, this scene would have died a long, long time ago. And it's absolutely true. You didn't buy Anarchy in the UK because it was a great decision. No, of course, it's brilliant, you know, it's fantastic. But there was all the other associations that you kind of fed into unwittingly and unknowingly. And also it's also the same with the film, I think. And I think that Malcolm rightly is the catalyst, and he's the one that made punk ignite, and in terms of, you know, popular culture, and he did this through his belief in the ideas associated with punk and the great kind of slogans that came out, like, you know, the believe in the ruins, and anyone can be a Sex Pistol, which is a fantastic idea, which goes back again to the kind of demystification of the superstar ethos from Andy Warhol, where you get some kind of junkie as a superstar and kind of being built up as such. And again, it's that idea that anyone can do it. You can do it. You can go out and do it. And that was the overriding idea of punk, because that is exactly the same, has exactly the same meaning as Don't Dream It, Be It. All these films have. And Malcolm was the one who really realised this, and he put it forward. And although, yes, he kind of jokingly portrays himself as the trickster, as the person who swindled the music biz for his own personal gratification or his own fun, I think that he was a very idealistic person who wanted to see revolution in kind of every sense. And I think he was right to use all the Sex Pistols money in making this film. And I think the only tragedy really is that it was kind of taken away from him at the end by Julian Temple. But, you know, too late for Julian Temple to fuck it up completely. And, I mean, you know, yeah, Julian Temple's all right, but he's not Malcolm McLaren. Malcolm McLaren's a genius. Julian Temple, you know, he's all right, you know. But that Filth and the Fury film that he did was just a kind of collection of music vids and Johnny Rotten pretending to cry over Sid Vicious. It was all right, but it wasn't this. It wasn't.
Well, I guess the difference is, you know, at first, The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, I guess when it's first released, is like a postscript on punk, isn't it? Because if Sex Pistols were the post,
kind of. I mean, well, I think actually what it did is it kind of reintroduced punk into popular culture, because when, by 1980, I mean, punk wasn't kind of happening really. It kind of largely gone. I think it kind of reignited people's interest a lot.
And I'm sure it did in that sense, but in terms of the Sex Pistols being poster boys for the punk explosion, they'd already finished, hadn't they? So the idea of a film
that's exactly right. And anyone can be a Sex Pistol, and the band don't matter. What was important was the ideas. And I mean, the ideas, it was it goes back to the idea of boredom and emptiness that we kind of see in Warhol. And we see Malcolm, whose way of combating that emptiness and boredom kind of, it was inspired by, you know, his interest in situationism, which is where you had the so-called spectacle, which is a construct of boredom and emptiness. And I mean, Malcolm took that situationist idea of using, you know, improvisation and transitory kind of situations, as you like, to combat that. So a situation could be anything from some kind of psychogeographic drift in, or a political prank, and or a film. And this was it. This was Malcolm's way of attacking the spectacle. And it was a Situationist Maneuver, and it was actually absolutely fantastic.
Do you not think, though, there's a chicken and egg, though, about punk, in a sense? Sort of, obviously, there's the chicken and egg that says there is no Sex Pistols without Malcolm McLaren, and there is no Malcolm, then the other way around goes, there is no Malcolm McLaren without the Sex Pistols.
I think he'd have done it in some other way.
Really?
It wouldn't have been punk, but it would have been something. Maybe through, I don't know, film, clothes, Whatever. You know, we're talking about kind of ideas and how magically they kind of, if you do what you love and you do what you believe, how magically they're kind of, you know, transformed into something. And I mean, you know, would it have mattered if the Sex Pistols hadn't existed? I mean, I don't know. There's loads to talk about in this. There's a whole idea of play power and how things, you know, don't be an adult, you know. Too much to talk about now. Let's do a part two.
Well, look,
but the Rock and Roll Swindle, you know, fabulous.
I think it gets better with age. The further it gets away from 1980, the more it becomes a document of its time and less about where punk was in 1980.
I think that it kind of lives and dies with Malcolm, and I mean, people kind of go through these periods of either hating him or kind of loving him. I mean, you know, he hasn't really got a great name, I guess, at the moment, but there have been periods when he has had a great name, and
the film doesn't help any accusations of exploitation that were put to him, you know, in terms of his own benefit.
Well, no, because I mean, it's funny because I mean, you can actually kind of, you know, that whole idea of the trickster that he actually promotes. Mm. I mean, you know, even that's a trick, really, because I think the thing about Malcolm McLaren was that he trod that kind of fine line between, you know, wanting pure rebellion and wanting to be accepted. And that's what kind of put punk his ideas and punk on the level which brought it to people like me.
I'm going to say, in a nutshell, there you've kind of nailed a lot of things. Everyone could be an outsider. They follow the path of what they love. That becomes more popular, and then when you try and move on to the inside, you don't fit. So you'll end up being repelled by the thing that got you going in the first place.
Yeah, well, everything has its kind of arc, doesn't it?
Indeed. Well, look, we're going to complete the arc now, and we're going to jump beyond punk, as it were, as a period of time when it was instigated, to real post-punk. And this was a real surprise to me, and it was a real pleasure to go back and watch this ahead of the podcast. I'm talking about 1987's With Nail and I, which obviously is set in 1969. So it's kind of, it's all over the place in terms of punk's narrative. So where for you does this sit as a piece of punk art, a punk film?
Well, I think it's an ending film. It's the film is actually full of endings. And I mean, every arc, and we're talking about the arc of punk at the moment, has its beginning and ending. That's not to say that after an ending arc there aren't other arcs, but this is its own one in this context. So, you know, With an Eye is a 60s film. It's kind of set in the 60s, and it was released in 1987, I think it was, something like that. And it's a 60s film because you have those kind of characters like, you know, Danny, who was the drug dealer, and you still had those kind of characters in punk, actually. I mean, people like kind of Danny, who they didn't kind of go away. They kind of stumbled from one street corner to the next street corner, and that next street corner in Ladbroke Grove was kind of punk rock. They were kind of around, you know. that sort of biker.
Who will buy my speed? Anyone will buy my speed.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and the music was 60s, but really it was kind of as much of an 80s film as it was a 60s film, because it dealt with a couple of things. One, which was the commodification of countercultural ideals, which you know, they're selling hippie wigs in Woolworths, man.
I've forgotten that's where that line come from till my recent rewatch, because like I knew that line more than knew the film.
So it deals with that and the kind of malignant effects of the, I suppose, the ideology that took their place, which is Thatcherism and, you know, corporate culture, which Jubilee also dealt with in a different way. And what Withnail and I did was they dealt with it in an extraordinarily funny yet poignant way. And it's a it has that kind of post-war kitchen sink sense of kind of hopelessness. And to anybody who's kind of ever squatted, it kind of makes complete sense. These characters just kind of, you know, not even squatted, just, you know, being young and come to an end of a period. And you have that kind of existential melancholy where it's all coming to an end. It's all over, really. And these are really people who don't really know what to do next. And if you were of a certain age in the mid to late 80s, and you had invested a lot of time and energy into something called punk rock, and your own kind of personal self into that ideal, then by 1987, believe me, you had come to realize that there's nothing kind of left, and
The roadmap had run out at that point then.
The roadmap had run out, and this is largely what Looking for a Kiss, my book that I mentioned before, is about. It's about a couple of people who have invested all their energy into an ideal, who have and into themselves as a couple, and who have reached the end. And they perhaps do not know, or I think one of them actually does not know, and perhaps still doesn't know, really what on earth to do next. And I talk about this, and I write about these characters. They go and see the film, and to read a little bit out of it.
Go on.
Out of the book might explain something about why this film is important and put it into context. A little while in the future, he could see both of them, that is, both he, Robert, and his girlfriend, Marlene, on the bus up Haverstock Hill to the Hampstead Classic, where they watched Withnail and I. This film had a big impact on both Robert and Marlene. The journey back was made in silence. The atmosphere, one of suspicion. They gave each other the odd penetrative look, jealousy. Both of them identified with Withnail, the unreconstructed, hopeless boozer and loser. Marlene was something of a professional punk, while at the same time working shit jobs for speed and booze money. The house in co-op rent was nothing, food, fuck all. They lived on lentils. However, Marlene had got the wrong idea about punk from the start. Punk was, in effect, a way of stopping your past from becoming your future. But from 1976 onwards, Marlene was trapped in that punk moment like a fly in piss-coloured amber. No wriggle room forever. Punk had not freed her. She was instead imprisoned by the character she had assumed at that time. Just like her hero, Johnny Rotten, who seemed to have or portray only one emotion over the course of his whole career and life, anger, bad energy forever. Marlene's life was not underpinned by momentum, but by nostalgia. Marlene fucking hated Robert. In the film, he was I, and was going to escape the squalor and the waste and embark on a career. He was going to fucking fulfill himself. She was meant to be the star. Stardom, stardom, stardom. She craved it. She could see it. She could almost taste it. That film tonight Marlene came out with, you are I and I am with now. I am I. I and I, Marlene misheard, wondering for a second why Robert was using the Rasta phrase. What? No, I am not. I am with Nail, he insisted. You are I. A compromise was reached. We are I, Robert said. You and I are I. You mean we are with Nail, Marlene corrected. With Nail and we. And it was the story is all about trying to find something else. And famously in the film, it is I who finds a way out and with Mel who perhaps doesn't. And so that's why Withnail is a punk film. It works on a personal level, and it works on a wider ideological framework, really. And it's superb.
And also the way you what you're describing there with your characters, I saw echoes of that when Acid House had fallen, you know, it stopped being what it was and became everything became legal and it became more mass and it was not what it was. And then everybody talked about that there was nostalgia for something within 3 years of it happening. And it was really interesting because they knew they'd lost something that they, at the time when it was happening, it felt fantastic and it felt that it could last forever. But then it slowly but surely disintegrated. And I think, I guess the reflection there was that we'd already experienced that with the explosion of punk culture. And then as people drift away from it, the foundations of it are not always what they were, I suppose.
Well, it goes back to what we were saying about punk and that it wasn't a youth movement as such. It wasn't that because it had too much in it and it's still got too much in it. You can call it punk, you can call it something else. So it's not as simple as that for people like Marlene and Robert, because, you know, on one level they really understood that, but on another level they had to live, they had to survive. You have to eat, and you're always pressured by, you know, the outside world and peers who are doing other stuff, doing well. I think the thing about arcs and beginnings and endings, it's the same thing with scripts. With film scripts, and as a script writer, I'm sure that you know yourself that you break film scripts down into acts, and you break it down further, and you break it down really into that kind of step outline format. And you know what? I mean, you know, yes, you have an arc, but every little bit of a film, and by that I mean every little bit of a life, has its own arc. So there isn't just one arc, there's loads of arcs, and then you have an overriding arc, and that's what makes it all doable.
Do you know what that that chimes with? I recently did a podcast with a guy who's written a book on screenwriting called Beyond the Hero's Journey, which was this, you know, the hero's journey was this notion that arcs were about one person's story. And the argument here was all stories about character arcs, whether it be the long one or the short one, that they're all characters are having some form of an arc or another. Or if they're not, the world outside them is changing and they're not, which is that where you get that resistance and frustration that what I've chosen to do is now out of step.
Absolutely right. And if they don't change, if there isn't an arc in every little bit, then the film's boring. That's what makes films, books boring, because you don't have that. It's very flat. And it's the same with lives. People get bored because they're not changing. They're not, you know, they've kind of abandoned their arc. And it goes back to that whole magical kind of ideal of an arc being a kind of same as an orbit. And you know, you have that idea of, and again, this goes back to the kind of star system, the kind of link it up where every man and woman is a star. And it doesn't mean, you know, I know it's an Aleister Crowley quote. It doesn't mean that everyone is a kind of like celebrity. What it means is everyone finds their own orbit. And, you know, what you're meant to be, you find yourself and you're on that orbit, and that orbit is, hey, it's an arc. So,
no, I agree, because you get that, because you have the notion of, you have the energy when you're young, and then you maybe do end up getting trapped, is maybe too strong a word, but you get into a rhythm, which is you earn, you pay mortgages or rent or whatever it might be. And there's a sense of progression that's not on your terms. And then you might reach a ripe old age and you then can make choices again. So you had choices when you were young and then very few choices because of the pressure, the external pressures of life.
Yeah,
and then suddenly people start rebelling against being a bit older. And it's like suddenly you've got the same, you're feeling like the same freedoms you had when you were 20.
Yeah. And the thing about endings is there's always another beginning. And that's the glory of it all, you know.
Yeah. If you get a chance to see it, there's a film called Knives and Skin by a director called Jennifer Reeder. And in her film, she has three coming of ages. So she has the usual one, which is the teenage girl. Then she has the mother having her own coming of age. And then she has the grandmother having come of age. All like three generations of women within one film having their current coming of age.
What's it called?
It's called Knives and Skin. It's a really, really interesting film on that front. But let me run down the five films you've chosen to remind the audience as to the five great punk films we've discussed. 1966's Chelsea Girls by Andy Warhol. 1975's The Rocky Horror Picture Show, directed by Jim Sharman. 1978's Jubilee, directed by Derek Jarman. 1980's The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, directed by Julian Temple, but as we've established, very much made by Malcolm McLaren. 1987 With Nell and I, written and directed by Bruce Robinson. I think from what you've talked about and with the help of the excerpts on your book, I think you've explained brilliantly why you've chosen the ones you've done, you know, outside of like Jubilee and Great Rock and Roll Swindle being like obvious because of their direct punk links and the time they were made. But I think between them and also, when you talk about your narrative arcs, I suppose, you know, Andy Warhol to Malcolm McLaren is like passing a baton on, isn't it, in some senses?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally and absolutely. And I chose them all because, again, like they all feed in and inform my book, Looking for a Kiss. And can I say two lines about that? Oh, I just wanted to say that Looking for a Kiss is set in post-punk London and New York, and it's a fabulous chronicle of speed, madness, and flying saucers. That's a Warhol, Edie Sedgwick reference, and it's acid, pop art, teenage perversity, breakdown, breakup, breakout, the nature of melancholy, the spectacle, bathroom functions, clairvoyance, personality crises, primal scenes, screams, schemes, the eternal quest for cool and the endless search for redemption and more. and it was... it was described by one person, a writer for International Times, as a Jarman-esque journey in Vivian Westwood Hill's to Love's Shrine, and by someone else as a bittersweet Coltrane solo crashing into Einstürz and Now Barton, and by someone else as a drug-fueled beat punk love-hate story like Kerouac shot through with sadness, not just the come down but the inability to bridge the gulf between a enlightened moment of beatitude and the bleak surroundings you exist in the rest of the time. But it's also quite sort of funny and perky as well.
And the having gone through this conversation with you, then the obvious last question then is like, how did you find sort of weaving fiction into the sort of the facts of punk, as it were, that you're drawing on?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been asked this before. It's kind of, did you base it on your own life? And my answer always is it goes back to what we were talking about before, which was, you know, is it exactly what happened? Is that what happened? Well, no, not really. But is it the truth? Yes, it's the truth. Absolutely. And that, I think that's what I think that's what real fiction is, actually. So there.
I concur. Well, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast.
Well, thank you, and sorry for running over the time of the barking dog. It was wonderful fun talking to you, Stuart. It really was, and I hope that people find some interest in it somewhere along the line.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.